Talking with Eric Hill on 7 March 78 at Radio Physics in Sydney. Now, can you tell me what your educational background was and how you first came into contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I was a graduate in physics from Melbourne University, majoring in theoretical physics, and I went to work at the Mount Stromlo Observatory for about... Well, after getting a master's degree in Melbourne, I went to work at Mount Stromlo for about a year or so. In that time, I'd applied for a CSIRO overseas research grant and scholarship, and I acquired one and was attached to, because of my astronomical background, to the Division of Radio Physics. Not as a theoretician primarily, but with the intention of becoming a normal practical type of astronomer. They were not interested in my theoretical physics background at all.
But it's interesting that they were taking someone who was an optical astronomer, if anything.
They were taking a person whom they thought had the basis of understanding optical astronomy. There was no one in the laboratory who had that background in those days. And they just felt that I could probably complete my education, particularly in the galactic and extragalactic field.
Mm-hmm.
At Leiden Observatory in Holland.
So it was the division's choice to send you to Leiden?
Yes, it's not mine.
Mm-hmm. And you were telling me that you got there a few months after the hydrogen line was discovered?
Yes, at that time they had the, I think it was a Wurzburg dish.
Right.
They had made their preliminary observations of the line, and they just began an extensive survey of the line around as much of the galactic equator as they could possibly do.
So this was late 51 then, probably?
Well, something in that, about that time.
And
I could probably dig up the accurate dates if you wanted them.
And did you become involved in this hydrogen line?
No, I was, as the laboratory really wanted me to get involved in the optical side of things, they felt that I'd be better doing something else. And I think the Dutch people, of course, wanted to keep the new field pretty much amongst themselves anyway. So it didn't really worry me much. I got involved in the determination of the galactic gravitational field perpendicular to the plane, but using studies of stellar motions as the distance indicator rather than brightness of stars.
Which is what Oort had done in this...
Well, Oort hadn't done it this way. As I recollect, Oort had done it quite possibly from just brightness distribution of the stars. But for many years, people had collected measurements of proper motions and radial velocities of the stars, but no one had ever seriously used this information to span the distance scale with this in this sort of way. So it was new in that regard, new technique, and...
And Oort put you onto this?
Yes,
from...
yes. I was under Blau, actually.
And, oh, you were working with Blau also?
I was with Blau, yes. Yeah. He was my immediate supervisor. So I was in Holland that I often look back at as the most memorable part of my scientific life, actually.
And why is that?
It's a very unusual experience to be in a laboratory where... so many important discoveries are made in such a short span of time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a period where they put an enormous amount of effort, Oort and students and everybody virtually, just sat in a great room processing this data by hand. And week by week, new discoveries were coming out, new values of the galactic rotation curves were coming out, much more extensive values. They were pulling out at first the spiral structure near the sun, and later on the spiral structure in towards the centre of the galaxy. Those were the sorts of things, and these were pouring out new things almost week by week from this work.
Were any of these particularly surprising to the people as they found them, or was it just a matter of the joy of being able to finally get a handle on some of these things?
I think there were surprises in that... Well, the big surprise, I suppose, might well have been the fact that they could
disentangled spiral structure so far away. I think optical astronomers up to that time had an idea from perhaps diffuse nebula observations and the like of some sort of spiral structure near the sun.
Yeah.
But these people were covering, spanning the whole of the galaxy. They were going right to the other side. And this in itself was an enormous thing. But as well, they were determining the rotation curve right towards the centre of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. They could determine the densities of hydrogen, neutral hydrogen everywhere in the system. So it was...
The extent in the z-direction...
The extent in the z-direction they've studied as well in the line measurements, but...
The physical state of the gas also, of course.
The physical state of the gas, the temperature of the gas, and density. But I think the things that cause the most fascination were these rotation curves, these spiral curves that were coming out. Because nobody had got anywhere near this sort of...
Right. But you were more an observer for all of this sort of thing. You didn't take part.
I didn't take part in any aspect whatsoever of that project. I just I shared a room with Schmidt, and Schmidt used to, when he got excited, used to sing, and I had to sort of bear this my own work and sit there envious of these discoveries that he and the others were making and so forth. But, I did get involved at the time in the new determination of the Oort constants. They were interested in the values of these at that moment. And this work I did in the first few months, this was strictly under Brad Lau's supervision. But that gave me an insight into the optical measurements of radial velocities and and proper motions and the effects of selections and the like on these measurements. And these were, this was a sort of forerunner to a major problem of the KZ gravitational field.
So this led to a large paper in around 55 in BAN.
Yes, this was basically, it was a thesis paper, but I didn't stay long enough to submit it as a thesis. So it was, I just returned and finished writing it up and sent it back to Holland.
Mm-hmm.
That was the KZ. The A and B work was never published.
The Oort constants stuff.
I don't know why. They were sometimes quoted, but I've forgotten the reason why.
So you came back to 55, and now with this more traditional astronomical training, what did Apasi assign you to do?
Well, I was assigned to the Mills Cross survey project, which had begun to yield observations possibly 6 months or 9 months prior to this time. The Mills Lee paper had been produced, and I was brought in to more or less take charge of the data collection and to share with Bruce Lee the analysis primarily of the source counts, because this was the big pointed issue at the time. There was nothing nothing surpassed this question. We had to resolve this matter of what the distribution of the sources in terms of intensity was.
The log in, log out.
Yes, there was no there was no shadow of doubt that we were not confusion limited, but we had every confidence that the Cambridge people were, because we could actually explain a lot of their confusion effects. We had a resolution of about a degree, as I recall.
Right.
They had a beam that was fan-wise, I don't know, 6, 10, 15 degrees north-south, as I recall, remember. And so they had a lot of confusion stuff, and we could actually see the confusion effect that they would see. But
In retrospect, looking back at the confusion level that you quoted for the Mills, for the MSH survey, do you think it was perhaps a bit low? I mean, that you underestimated a bit?
It's conceivable that we did, because the sources of... Well, I think we maintained that everything above 20 flux units were quite genuine sources, but there were problems always with side lobes. But we thought that we knew where these side lobes were.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think that on the basis of evidence we had, the 20 flux units was reasonable.
Mm-hmm. So now continuing with AC power, so the speed should be correct. You mentioned that you were at the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 55.
Yes.
Can you tell me what your recollections were of that?
I forgot what I said. The main point, although the Jodrell Bank Symposium covered many aspects of radio astronomy, the aspect of greatest interest to everybody, hopeful of a fight and meaty discussion, was the question of the source counts, the contention or the dissension between the Sydney Mills survey and the Cambridge survey with Ryle was crowded. Performed, and particularly the theoretical interpretation of these source counts. I don't, as at the time, I had been sent over from Leiden. I was working on quite a different project, and so my recollection of that meeting is just of the atmosphere of it rather than.
Well, but this is valuable. You were a bit of a neutral observer, although I'm sure you were still an Australian at heart in some sense, but. Mm. So how did you see it, though, and what happened?
Well, wisely, I think Pawsey was the only Australian speaker representative at this meeting. He contributed a sense of remoteness and provided, I think, a dispassionate sort of approach to the whole subject. But despite his level-headed and diplomatic approach to things, the discussion flared up repeatedly in a almost violent form between the several English people there, notably Ryle, and as I recollect, either Bondi or Gold. Mm-hmm. Bondi, Gold or Hoyle, I think. As I recollect, these Big Bang theorists were a bit in favour of our observations at that time. And,
steady state, you mean?
Steady state people.
Right.
And they were more or less adding to what Pawsey was saying.
Right.
On their own views on the question of confusion and the like. And I remember three or four occasions where yelling across the meeting between these people became quite mm-hmm. formidable.
I don't think the Mills and Sleet paper had actually been published then, but it must have been a preprint.
I think it was a preprint. It may have been available just as a set of typed notes prior to submission, but I'm fairly certain that at that time those counts that were under discussion were the counts that came out of the Millsley work.
Yeah, I think that's
work,
correct.
Which were eventually published. But the subsequent counts that we made over a much more extensive range of declination did very little, I think, to modify them.
I'll have to check whether the actual preprint was available, because there were some strong words in that preprint about the Cambridge survey essentially being completely wrong. But then saying 98% of the sources are no good.
Yes.
And, you know, those are strong words.
Yes, I don't think it turned out, in fact, that that was so, but...
Well, it wasn't too far from the truth, though, was it?
No, it was fair. We considered, I think... I would have thought, you know, something of the order of half we would have thought were pretty fictitious. And it always mystified me, really, why the Cambridge people in public stuck so much to their guns, because the evidence against their conclusions was so obvious. But behind all this was quite a striking thing that just before, I think, this conference, Oort had had a terrible bout of pneumonia, and but while he had that bout, he'd received a copy from Ryle of the paper,
mm-hmm.
particularly the interpretation of their source counts. And he came out one day reeking of this pneumonia to the coffee room, mm-hmm. and loudly acclaimed that this was the most fantastic paper that he'd ever read. And none of us would touch it because it was written with pneumonia germs and so forth. But coming from a man like Oort, that was a terribly strong sort of a statement.
Right.
And I didn't dare say too much at that stage because I felt that there must have been something funny about the observations themselves, but nevertheless the
weight of views of a man like Ord.
You felt that even before you went to Jadwal Bank, you're saying?
Yes, because we'd had visits and occasionally letters from people in Australia. There were contacts, primarily through Christensen and Kerr in those days. Mm-hmm. And Pawsey had drifted in once or twice, and I had letters from him. And just from what I had gleaned there, that if the pencil beam survey of the cross was valid, then there just had to be confusion in this Cambridge thing, and they felt that they could explain the confusions quite simply.
I see.
They could see the confusion effects of that the Cambridge people could observe. So superficially, it seemed a fairly clear-cut issue that the Cambridge people really couldn't defend that survey.
I'm really puzzled too why they made such a bad mistake and stuck with it, like you say, a year or two before they began backing down somewhat.
I think it was a matter of saving face. The interesting point about that particular issue is that Ryle had it up to that time, and has continued to show ever since, that he was enormously clever in not only developing new techniques, but also in picking subjects to concentrate on. And I think that, with that sort of intellect, I think that it was just a matter of, trying to save face as long as possible. They knew what they had to do to clarify the issue, and they went pretty smartly about it with their later surveys. But I think it was just a personality business. There were ill feelings between he and Burney, and it was just pride. But I'm sure in his heart that he really knew that things were wrong.
And the what about the P of D analysis while we're talking about these things? Did that, for you yourself, for instance, did that have much basis?
No, I didn't really get terribly involved in that at all, actually. In relation to the survey, I was mainly instrumental in getting the counts and the essence of the relation of intensity against distance and so forth was worked out by Burney from the initial work of Melvin Slee, and so I really didn't do much in it.
Okay, well, we haven't talked about, can you tell me now about how you and Bruce Slee reduced this data?
It was a nightmare. I can't recall the details of all the records that were taken, but we used to get something like 300 or 600 feet of chart a day. This went on
300 to 600.
Yes, each with intensity deflections separated by perhaps a tenth of an inch. And these were interlaced as the beam scan over the five, as I recollect, beam positions. You'd get one sequence of five and then you'd start again.
Mm-hmm.
This went on hour after hour.
And how many total days, roughly, were there in that survey?
I don't know. You could roughly estimate. I couldn't do it offhand, but I have a recollection that it used to take us... One pass of the sky would take us easily 6 or 9 months of observing, and two and part three sets of scans were produced. And these chart records had to be transferred. We had to disentangle the five beams. They were all interlaced in the original record, so the whole thing had to be copied onto tracing paper, and the whole object being to separate the five beams. And these had to be smoothed and joined up into the five individual tracings, and then the work was handed over to Bruce and myself to process this for source positions and fluxes and angular sizes, and subsequently into contour maps. Small contour maps were made early in the piece, particularly of the Centaurus A source, which turned out to be a very extended one and gave a lot of detail. Kevin Cherin did that, and people like Alec Little contributed some work on some gaseous nebulae, I think, as I recollect.
Right.
These are small introductory papers.
What was the definition of a source on the...
The source was a... something of amplitude, about three times the noise level.
The root mean square noise?
Yes, mm-hmm. Three times that, as I recollect, three or five. And of reasonable width, certainly not less than the beam, up to some limit, I think, of four or five beam widths was some right. sort of upper limit, as I recollect. And something that was also reproducible. We had at least two and quite often three passes of voices in the sky, so they had to be reproducibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be away also from the side lobe areas. We knew where the side lobes would occur from the stronger sources.
How many sources actually did you include in that those forbidden zone, so to speak?
I don't recollect, but I would suspect that if we... that if we quoted a 20 flux unit limit in the cooler areas of the sky away from the galactic plane, we would have made that limit perhaps 100 or so in the areas mm-hmm. of those side lobes.
That's probably given in the paper, I guess.
Yes,
which sources
yes.
you...
We had no idea, as I recollect, of the phase, the way in which the phase of a strong source would interfere. So you couldn't really do much to try and calculate out the effect of a side lobe and analyse what was left.
Mm-hmm.
We just couldn't do this. We just had
cleaning, you would call it nowadays.
Yeah, there was no attempt at cleaning.
Yeah.
So we just looked for sources of perhaps four or five times the sort of flux we might have expected.
What was the intensity of these side of the strongest side lobes, relative intensity?
Oh, they could be many times at 20 flux units. Particularly near the sources, the mm-hmm. intensity declined a lot when you got away.
And so this analysis of a year, I guess 2 years worth of data, something like that, took several years in itself, mm-hmm. I guess. Was it sort of a one-to-one ratio?
Yes, I was doing nothing else at the time.
Yeah. And the survey itself came out in three installments in the late 50s.
Yes. And then there was a
early 60s.
And an edit of the whole thing at the end.
An edit of the
correction.
Thing.
But these were only minor
mm-hmm.
improvements that were made.
Am I correct in saying that you did not actually worry about the cosmological interpretations?
No.
But in fact, the entire survey did more or less back up what the first Mills and Slee
yes, as I
paper
recollect,
had said.
It substantiated all that had been said. And we did some work. When this was being done, we did always keep an eye on the 3C, I think it was 2C or 3C catalogue.
Well, the 2C was the bad one.
It was a confusion,
right.
Yeah. We had this by our side all the time, and I remember when we finished the survey, just having a look at the 2C
mm-hmm.
catalogue against our maps, and it was quite obvious that if our maps had any validity, they could explain a lot of the confusion phenomena
mm-hmm.
that the Cambridge people had experienced. I think that one of the things that blocked Ryle in his accepting our counts was that he just wouldn't accept our counts to begin with. If he'd said, well, supposing the Slee, Mills Slee counts were right, are my observations confused? It would have been quite obvious to him. He could pick out instances all over the overlapping part of the sky where we could just say just what was causing his confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't explain everything, but many instances, it was quite obvious to the.
But he wasn't even willing to make that assumption.
He wasn't willing to make that assumption, I don't think.
Mm. Did you go to the Paris Symposium meeting, per chance, in 58? Is there anything else about the Mills survey that you think I should probably move on?
The Mills survey was the last survey, a big survey made by this laboratory with equipment that had built and paid for itself. After that, the Parkes dish came along. That was only a well, as I recollect, it was the cost of that was shared primarily between the Carnegie and
Ford Foundation.
Ford Foundation. Right. This laboratory paid, you know, for the receivers and things like that, paid the staff and so forth.
Right.
But the Bell's Cross, I'm pretty certain you can say it was the last. Even
the last in-house, more
in-house
or less.
Product.
And another thing that was, you were telling me, was the last hand-reduced large
that
survey.
That was the last hand-reduced product. The Mills survey had taken a very, very large chunk of the time of, in reducing anyway, of five people. It's taken about 5 to 10 man years, I suppose.
Well, in a couple of women years.
That's including
women. That's including.
And that's just in the reduction of people like Kevin and Alec Little and Bruce Lee. They had to keep the equipment going as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual processing of that data took this enormous amount of time. And I resolved that although I was still interested in surveys, I was never going to do them that way anymore. The end of the Mills Cross survey marked the end of the in-house production of a new piece of equipment,
mm-hmm.
and it marked also the end of an era in human processing of data.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Parkes Radio Telescope began, my first object was to make a survey of the sky at the best resolution we could get at that time, and it was mainly limited by the receivers available, and that was done at 20 centimetres, where we had something like 3 or 4 times the resolution we had with the Mills Cross.
There was a 10 centimetre receiver, wasn't there?
There was a 10 centimetre receiver, but at that time it was very unstable and unreliable, and even the 20 centimetre receiver was not the best. They've built better ones since, but it was quite good enough to do the job again. My interest mainly at that stage was not so much the sources away from the galactic plane. It was not the intent to do a source survey in the Mills, extragalactic survey in the Mills sense, but to do the galactic plane in particular,
mm-hmm.
with this resolution, but to try out the newer techniques of digital processing, digital collection of data. So we recorded everything on chart paper in analog form, but this was never ever used, fortunately. It was all recorded on paper tape, and we literally had scores of miles of paper tape,
mm-hmm.
Torn, as I recollect, the effects of seized up punctures threaded throughout it.
And what kind of a computer was that analyzed on?
Well, the initial processing was done on a machine called Celiac, which was a copy of Iliac, I think Iliac 1, that was built at Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
Celiac was built by the Sydney University, and at that time you could feed paper tape data into it. And so we did some of the preliminary work that way. None of us actually involved in radio astronomy had any experience programming. And so we started to work on processing this paper tape on the Celiac, which only had 1,000 words of memory and no such thing as Fortran available to it. All had to be done in machine code. No such thing as floating point software, you had to write your own.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to fit these masses of data into a machine with your program, all in 1,000 words of core. Well, this didn't last very long, and we started, since CSIRO had no machine, we started looking around, and the nearest machines available to us for this work were commercial IBM machines, so we did a lot of the initial processing on commercial machines using Fortran. This was about the first time we'd ever had the opportunity to use Fortran.
Were these 7094s?
No, they were 1401s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very, very slow machines. It was a rather costly operation. And we managed with that method. Celiac had
done nothing but give us a preliminary feel of what digital computers were about and the like. And but it was through the this IBM 1401 that we first got our data from paper tape onto magnetic tape. And we wanted to produce contour plots of everything, automatic contour plots. Mm-hmm. And the 1401 proved too slow a machine for us, but at least we had the data on magnetic tape. So we took these over to Weapons Research Establishment in South Australia and started processing this magnetic tape data. And after about 6 months of that, we had got to nearly to the point where we could produce contour plots. I think the first, I don't know, there may have been a few people in radio astronomy who had done this before, but I doubt it.
Mm-hmm. This was about when now you're talking, what year?
This would be around 1960, I suppose.
60? Now hold on.
Yes.
The Parkes telescope began in 61.
61, it would be about end of 62. We'd have got to this point. Yeah.
What kind of a plotter was it?
Well, the plotter that we, at that time on the 7090, there was no plotter, but we were able to get our data in the form of contour information. At that time, CSIRO had established its complex in Canberra, the network in Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide, and the like, and they all had, all those machines had plotters on them, so the data which was in contour form from the 7090
was
then transferred to the 3600 control data.
It seems like you probably spent as many man years on this, except it was probably much more interesting.
It was interesting, and but I think I suppose it was, well, it certainly was as much agony as the manual processing of the Mills Cross information, but was in a sense productive agony because we were opening a new field of, for the division.
Right.
And it was obviously going to help everybody a lot to get these things threshed out, and somebody had to face it.
You had to gain the experience.
So it was really not agony in the true sense. It was hard but useful toil that we were involved with.
Let me ask you about the review paper that you wrote with Pawsey in 61 and reports on progress in physics. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
I think that Pawsey was asked to write this paper by people, Royal Physical Society or someone, and I had come back, and Pawsey never explained why he called, asked me to help with this, but I sensed that I was the sort of youngest and newest member of the division at the time, and it would be a good idea to, a good way anyway, of forcing me to come to grips with other aspects of radio astronomy.
And
line work in particular, I hadn't any connection with. Low frequency work, and also aerial design, receiver capabilities, and things like this.
You said that your job in particular was to certify the accuracy of every...
Yes, I was allowed to rewrite sections of it. Where if something interested me considerably, I go back to the original papers and perhaps rewrite sections of the matter, but primarily it was hack work for the chief at the time.
And also, you were telling me before, could you repeat that about Joe Pawsey himself, his role in the...
I think Joe Pawsey was one of the most remarkable men of Australian science. Perhaps he won't go down in history as having made the greatest discoveries in Australian science, but to my mind, he must go down in history as one of the greatest leaders of Australian science. And from what experience I've had overseas in Holland, and what I've seen happening in England, he must go down as one of the leading directors of science in the world. Although he didn't get actively involved in observations, he kept a very, very close watch on everything that was going on, and provided a lot of balanced advice, which even the best of us need from an outsider, sort of advisor, which is very, very hard to get these days. He was a stirrer, Causey. He'd just walk around the laboratory keeping everything stirred. And a person like that is, I think, one of the most useful people a laboratory can, can have.
Right.
The good stirrers, I think, are very rare animals.
He just didn't let things happen, you're saying? He,
No, he poked and prodded, and he stopped people doing this and advised people about how they were doing something else. And
which must have been frustrating at times.
Yes, frustrating. Well, perhaps not frustrating. People got to almost wince when he came through the door. But sitting back in retrospect, I think you'll find throughout the laboratory and the people who had to endure these visits have all come out of this experience with a remarkably high opinion of the man.
Yes, well, no, I've heard this over and over, yes. It seems to me that indeed, although he didn't publish much himself, that he was critical in almost all of the publications that came under this.
Yes, he was critical, and I think, you know, the development of new equipment that went on in those early days, the sea interferometer, the Mills Cross, the crisscross, back of all those things, none of those things would have come really into being but for Causey.
Mm-hmm.
He was the man who could see that these ideas were good, and he pushed them.
And back them, yeah. Or the spectrograph.
Yes,
well, the spectrograph.
Yes. But he also had, I think the other thing that one's got to say is that Causey was not the chief of the division in those days. In fact, he was never the chief of the division, but the chief of the division is Bowen, of course, and Bowen was the entrepreneur of the establishment, and everything he had in this sort of activity complemented what Causey had in his own technical sphere of governing the product. So between the pair of them, they were a remarkable combination. And I don't think either respected the other's contribution.
So, although
great pity, really.
Yeah, yeah. One final question. In the late 50s, say when you were working on the mill survey, someone asked you, what are you, what do you do? What did you answer then?
You mean someone
what
in
your profession?
Suburb where I
yeah.
live?
Yeah, what is your profession?
I would say I was a radio astronomer. And that would be the end of the matter. I think most times people didn't know what a radio astronomer was, and they really were not terribly interested in that.
Well, you were one of the few people who would call yourself that, though, and it's interesting to hear you say that. You see, you did have the astronomy background, and you were in radio.
I wouldn't call myself a radio astronomer. I'd call myself a radio astronomer in answering a question like that. But I never feel that I was a radio astronomer in the sense that Ryle and Mills and Slee and these people.
Well, but they wouldn't have called themselves radio astronomers.
Oh, I think they would.
No, I've asked them that question.
Well, that surprises me.
Radio physicist or...
Radio physicist.
Yes, or radio engineer or something like this.
Yeah, well, that perhaps goes back to their early associations
exactly.
with the laboratory.
Exactly.
But if somebody was to be called a radio astronomer, I would have said they would have been the most entitled people in the world to do so.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, I hope it's...
Okay, that ends the interview with Eric Hill on 7 March 78.